Masters for their hard work, the organisers of the new week, and of course the entire programme as well. This talk is the first of several on a project which I've been working on with the three authors listed here, Shiri Artstein, Frong Bart, and Asaf Naor. And my aim is to give some background to the project, so a little bit of history. That's about the first half of this talk. And then to describe the basic approach that we took to understanding entropy. And then in two subsequent talks, Shiri and Asaf will explain two different, although somewhat similar, applications of the basic method. Now, actually, the title is a bit of a misnomer, despite what Nicole said when she came in, because the random variables here don't, in fact, have to be identically distributed, and they don't actually have to be independent either. They can be vectors rather than variables. We don't have to add them. Although entropy was the main aim, almost the entire talk will be about information, and information doesn't grow, it decreases. So actually, the only real word that makes sense here is random. But this wouldn't be a very good title, so I had to expand it somehow. Now, what is the background? What is the setup to begin with? So we have a real random variable, x, with a density f on the line. We define the entropy, the information theoretic entropy, in this way, as long as it makes sense, and it makes sense under very, very weak assumptions. If we allow the value negative infinity in particular, it makes sense under very weak assumptions. Entropy measures the degree of uncertainty in a probability distribution. So roughly speaking, the entropy of a random variable is the number of questions you have to ask if you want to find out where the random variable actually, if you let the random variable happen, if you let it produce a value. The entropy tells you how many questions you have to ask or you expect to have to ask to find out which value you got, something like that. So it's the amount of uncertainty in the random variable. And typically when you have a random system which is changing, which is evolving, then it will evolve towards an equilibrium which has the maximum entropy. Entropy, of course, arose originally in thermodynamics where systems, where entropy increases, the world is running down. The particular random system that we're interested in is perhaps the simplest possible. We have IID random variables, despite what I said before. This was the original purpose of the project. We have IID random variables, and we add them, and we renormalize in L2. And so as long as these random variables do have variances, this will converge to the Gaussian limit. And what I am going to be interested in is how quickly it converges and how the entropy changes during that convergence. So because I'm talking about this situation, I'm going to normalize everything so that the random variables have mean 0 and variance 1. So I'm talking about the standard Gaussian as the limit. And sure enough, the limit has the largest entropy. As I said, the system evolves towards maximum entropy. Among variables with a given variance. And this is rather easy to see. So we have a density f and a density g, and we want that the integral of f log f is at least the integral of g log g. I've removed the minus sign, so I want the inequality going in the other direction. And the point is that this thing here is essentially x squared, the log of g, and they have the same variance, so this is the same as integral f log g. And we can now rearrange. This says that the integral of f log g over f is less than or equal to 0. And that follows because of the simple inequality. Log g over f is less than or equal to g over f minus 1. And the f's cancel out. And then you get two 1's which give you 0. So this is a very simple fact. Now, for any random variable x, the gap between its entropy and that of the Gaussian measures very strongly how close they are together. And in particular, it controls the total variation distance here, or at least the square of it. This inequality was originally due to Pinsker with a different constant, and then the correct constant was found later by Chisar and Kullback. So this is a very strong condition. This is much stronger than the central limit condition. If you know that the densities have a difference in L1, you know that the, and that is small, you know that all the probabilities are very, very close together. So this is much stronger than convergence in the central limit theorem. Now, soon after entropy was, probabilistic entropy was really brought into the picture, Shannon and Stamm, in slightly different ways, proved that if you have two IID random variables and you take the renormalized sum, then the entropy is at least as large as that of the originals. And so in particular, along the sequence of powers of two, the entropy increases. I've drawn all the points here, but what was known is that if you iterate this, obviously if you iterate this, the entropy increases. And it was a long-standing conjecture that the entropy should increase along all the sums. The reason that it was not proved, it was a different level of difficulty from x plus y over root 2, is that you can't represent the sum of three random variables in terms of the sum of two. You can't add 1.5 copies of the sum of two to get the sum of three. So this is really what caused the difficulty. Okay. So now let's have a little bit of the history of these issues. Under fairly weak assumptions, as long as the entropy of the random variable exists, one can show that it converges to that of the Gaussian limit along the whole sequence. Of course, we don't know it increases all the time, but you can interpolate in between the powers 2 to the k to get some kind of control of what it's doing. And you can check that it converges to the Gaussian limit. The history of this, Linnick was probably the first person who introduced entropy as a measure of distance to the Gaussian. His real aim was to give a different approach to the central limit theorem, and so he wanted to prove the central limit theorem for all random variables, but he did it by approximating by things for which the entropy existed, showed that for those the entropy converged, and then he went back and used that to get the central limit theorem in general. Brown started bringing in entropy, looking at it, as it were, for its own sake, rather than in connection with the classical central limit theorem. And Baron was probably the first person who actually proved the convergence in the entropic sense, namely that as long as the entropy exists, you get the entropy gap going to zero for random variables, for the appropriate random variables. Oh, let's see. Linnick is late 50s, I think. Baron, that the paper I'm thinking of there is probably early 70s, maybe. I'm not quite sure. Carlin and Sofer, the last statement, the last reference here, proved a uniform result of this kind. I'll explain what that means. Well, it's explained below. And their paper is late 80s, I suppose, something like that. 92, sorry. Okay, well, I wasn't too far wrong.
Baron was
86. Baron was 86? Oh, all right, okay. My apologies, I should have written it on there. Right. Now, when you prove these results, the main point is that if you have something which is not a Gaussian, and you take x plus y over root 2, then the entropy really goes up. So it's not just that it increases weakly, it really increases. And then in order to deduce the convergence, you use a compactness or tightness argument, as the probabilists call them. You have this increasing sequence. You say, okay, it tends to something. If that something is below a Gaussian, then when you get close enough, you'll hop over by compactness. And so there's absolutely no measure of how well this is happening or how quickly this is happening. It's purely a compactness argument. Carlin and Sofer, however, provided a uniform estimate in the sense that they showed that for random variables which satisfy a tail estimate, so you take a particular tail estimate, you look at the class of all random variables satisfying that tail estimate, then for those random variables, there is a uniform result saying that if you're this much away, epsilon away, you're guaranteed to jump at least delta, where delta depends on epsilon, and the tail estimate that your random variable satisfies. But again, this uses a compactness argument, a continuity argument, and so there was no measure of the relationship between delta and epsilon. It's purely a compactness statement. There exists a delta, and so on. Right. Now, our initial purpose in this work was to rectify that situation, to obtain quantitative estimates on the entropy jump for special classes of random variables. It's clear, or it's very easy to check, that you can't expect any kind of uniform estimate, let alone a quantitative one, unless you restrict the class of random variables. And our original aim was to look at logarithmically concave random variables because of geometric problems which we're interested in. And the logarithmically concave random variables are the functions which naturally extend the characteristic functions of convex sets to a class which is closed under convolution and various other things. So the example to keep in mind here is just the simple negative exponential random variable. So the density is e to the minus t on the right-hand half line. It's logarithmically concave, obviously, and it's somehow extremal in the sense of among logarithmically concave random variables. And when you take the normalized sums, you get a gamma random variable. This, of course, doesn't have mean zero, but so I'm violating my condition that I'm normalizing everything to have mean zero. But for this example, clearly we forget about that. So this is a gamma random variable, and you can expand the entropy in an asymptotic series in N, and the leading term for the gap is 1 over 3N. So in particular, the entropy gap narrows like constant over N as N increases. I'm sort of going to use the board from time to time, if you don't mind. I know it's a pain, but well, perhaps you're right. Perhaps I'm not going to use it that much. Now, what are the two results which will be proved in, or whose proofs will be outlined in the later talks? In the logarithmically concave case, we obtained the following, which tells us that the rate of decay of the entropy gap is indeed constant over n, the initial gap divided by n. And I've written it in this slightly strange way, 1 plus something times n on the bottom, because I want to draw attention to the fact that this actually tells us something even when n is 2. So when n is 2, it already tells us that we capture a fixed, we bite out a fixed proportion of the entropy gap, even with one convolution. Okay, when, in other words, this 1 is there from the start, in other words. And the second result is the solution of the problem I mentioned, stating that the entropy increases. Here there's no logarithmically concave assumption. X is essentially any old random variable for which the entropy makes sense. And then this the sequence increases with n, all values of n. Shiri will talk about this, and Asaf will talk about this, so it'll be in the opposite order. Indeed, it's logically more natural to have this one first, of course, but historically we came up with it the wrong way around for, I don't know, all kinds of reasons, but maybe that'll become clear when we when I go on. Right, now what is the starting point for the method? The starting point is something which was already well known and used by most of the authors that I mentioned in the earlier discussion. Instead of looking at entropy itself, they study the Fisher information, which for a real random variable is defined this way. You integrate f dash squared over f, or the way it arises is that you integrate the derivative of the square root of f, but of course we can write it in this form, f dash squared over f. And the Fisher information is, as it were, entropy upside down, so it's smallest for the Gaussian, and the Gaussian has the nice feature that its information is 1, whereas, of course, its entropy is something like a half 1 plus log 2 pi, which is a bit nasty, whereas the information is 1. So already you may get the impression that information is slightly easier to handle. And the idea is that the information decreases with repeated convolution down to the minimum. And for the case of 2 random variables, this here is, of course, the x plus y over root 2 statement is due to Blachman and Stamm. And the reason that we're able to consider information rather than entropy is that there's a remarkable connection between them provided by the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, which was discovered and proved in various degrees of generality and rigor by de Bruijn, Bakri and Emery, and Baron. And there's also a nice proof by Carlin and Sofer, which is very clean and clear in the paper that I referred to earlier. I suppose this is better over here. So let me explain that connection. What is the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup? This is a semigroup of convolution operators which reflects an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process. So that is, you start with a random variable, you let it evolve in what is like a Brownian motion, but in a potential well, so that it's constrained to maintain the same variance. So whereas a Brownian motion spreads out, the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck semigroup, the Ornstein-Uhlenbeck process continues with the same variance for all time. Now, the ordinates of the random variable you get, if you start with an initial density f, are given in this way. And you should understand that this is not, a path description of the process. Obviously, for a fixed... I mean, this would simply say that it's a kind of a funny exponential function. Obviously, it's not. It's a horrible random Brownian motion type function. This is simply a way of telling you the distribution of the t ordinate. Okay, this is not a path description. It's just a way of telling you what the distribution is. So, in other words, the pt applied to f, the density f, is the density of a random variable which could be obtained this way. So it's a combination of the original x with a Gaussian. And as t increases, what happens is you pass from x. When t is 0, you've just got x. As t goes to infinity, you just get g. So x is evolving to a Gaussian over time from 0 to infinity. Now, the densities you get this way, so if I call ft the density ptf, the density of the random variable at time t, it satisfies a kind of diffusion equation, but it's modified, so the usual diffusion equation would just be that, of course, for a Brownian motion. And here we're modifying it with this term, which is the term that brings the process back to towards zero at just the right rate to keep its variance the same. And you can easily check that if ft satisfies this condition, then the variance is unchanged. You integrate ft, and you can check that the derivative of the variance is zero directly from this diffusion equation. So all the information in principle is contained in this diffusion equation, modified diffusion equation. And what was discovered, and this is really rather lovely, is that if you differentiate the entropy down the semigroup, in other words, with respect to time, what you get is the information minus one, the information gap, in other words. The derivative of the entropy is the information gap. This is for a random variable with variance 1. Okay, so I'm only working here with variance 1. Obviously, if you renormalize, you can write down something that's true in general. And the result is that you can get the entropy gap by integrating the information gap. So if you get a nice linear inequality for information decrease, then you will be able to immediately to integrate it up to essentially the same inequality for entropy increase. In other words, decrease of the entropy gap. And this is rather nice, because although the information still looks a bit weird, I mean, f dash squared over f still doesn't look quite like the sort of thing you want to estimate, we have at least got rid of the logarithm, and it will turn out that this is the important point, at least for... it was the important point for most of the other authors, and indeed it is also the important point for us. Although it still looks a bit weird, it is a good deal easier to understand than the entropy. Right. Now, having introduced the information, I should mention that, by chance, quantitative estimates for information jumps have also been obtained by other authors, Baron, who was mentioned before, and a collaborator of his, Johnson, Their method is completely different, and it gives a nonlinear inequality, which therefore can't transfer to an entropy jump inequality. But they also found a very nice argument for getting the right constants asymptotically when you're looking at the entropy jump. And so it's well worth, I mean, if you're really interested in the subject, it's well worth reading their paper as well as ours. There's some complementary material there, which is very nice. Right, that really ends the background. So now I want to begin to introduce the approach that we took, describe what we did. So what have we got? We've got a random variable with a density f, and we want to relate the information, integral f dash squared over f, to the same thing for, let's say, x plus y over root 2. For the moment, I'll just consider the case of 2, and then later on we'll see how to extend to other situations. Now, the joint density of the pair x, y, of course, is the product, assuming these are independent, and the density of the normalized sum is a marginal of this. We just integrate out along lines for which x plus y over root 2 is constant. So, roughly speaking, the density is a convolution, of course, as we're well aware. And we want to try and relate the expression here involving f to the same expression involving the convolution. So we've got something like this, f star f dashed squared over f star f. And the difficulty, of course, is that f star f is an integral and it's still on the bottom. It used to be in the logarithm, which was really foul. Here it's on the bottom, which is fairly foul, but is better. Now, what is the main idea? It begins with a rather trivial observation. Suppose you know that the derivative decays at infinity, as it will certainly for log concave random variables. Then, of course, we can stick in an extra quantity here, f double dash, which will integrate to zero. And we can rewrite this expression, the integrand, as f times the second derivative of minus log f. In other words, we can rewrite it as precisely the thing that is positive if you have a log concave random variable. So we started off looking at log-concave random variables. It turned out that they were not actually the right things to look at, as we later discovered. But curiously enough, they gave us the hint as to the right thing to do. So this was just a strange fluke, really. So as I say, this quantity is the thing that is positive point-wise if you have a log-concave random variable. Right, why is that of interest? It's of interest because the Brumnikowski inequality from geometry, in its functional form, tells you that if you have a log-concave density, let's say, on the plane, then its marginals will also be log-concave. And we know that the convolution is the density of a marginal, that x plus y over root 2 has the density of a marginal. So Brumnikowski implies that if you start with log-concave random variables, then the sum is also log-concave. And therefore, in principle, somehow, Brumnikowski tells you something about this in terms of this. It's not entirely clear how it does it from the usual proofs, but at least in principle, you know that if minus log f double dashed is positive, then so is minus log f star f double dashed. So the point was to try and select an appropriate proof of Brumnikowski and to rewrite it so that it gave an explicit relationship between these two quantities, a point-wise relationship, as opposed to the usual proofs, which tell you if this is positive everywhere, then this is positive everywhere, which doesn't guarantee that there's a point-wise relationship of any sort at all, but the hope was that it would. So this was the step that started things off. Okay, I think I can replace that safely. Now, which proof did we select? We didn't have too much choice, at least we don't think we did. Most of the proofs of Brumnikowski are global proofs in the sense that you've got to prove something like you've got functions on three lines and you know that there's log concavity across the lines and you want to prove that the integrals satisfy an inequality. And the normal way of doing it is that you use values of the function which are widely spaced. Okay, you prove log concavity or concavity of the logarithm for the function using values of these functions which are widely spaced. And this is no good if we want to end up with a derivative statement. We need a local proof which we can take a limit, in which we can take a limit to get a derivative. But there was one such proof waiting to be used. That was the transportation proof, which is the reason that this talk is in this week, even though, as it will turn out, transportation is totally unnecessary for what we actually do. But it played a crucial role in discovering what to do, so this is why it appears in this week. Now, I'm only talking at the moment about random variables on the line, and the transportation in this case is a trivial transportation. If I want to transport the measure given by the density f to the measure given by g, I do it simply in this way. I choose an increasing function t with the property that the area up to z for f is the same as the area up to t of z. Sorry, the area up to z for g is the same as the area up to t of z for f. Infinitesimally, what I get is this. If I differentiate this statement here, I get that. And, of course, what this does is it produces a change of variable for us, which one wouldn't think of unless one had the idea of transporting measure. But once we've got that formula there, we can just, if we wish, regard it simply as a change of variable. And that's all I need to do here. Now, there is a proof of Brumminkowski based on transportation, which I'm not going to give, although many of you, I'm sure, know it. And what I'm going to do, in effect, is differentiate that proof, but I'm going to differentiate the proof without showing you the proof. Okay, so what's underlying this, the next step will be this idea of differentiating a proof, if one can do such a thing. Right, here goes. Actually, at this point, I think I would like to use the blackboard again. So if you just remember that bottom infinitesimal formula, which maybe I'll write down again, that's all we need. Okay. Yeah, that would save time, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, brilliant. Gosh. So what's the situation here? I have...
I'm going to put the light up a little higher.
Oh, don't worry. I'm sure this is okay. Yeah. I have a density on the plane. And I'm going to form the marginal. So I'm going to integrate on vertical lines. Let's say I have 0 here and u here. So h of u will be the integral. And then on each of these vertical lines, I can create a one-dimensional density by rescaling the w by the integral. So to produce integral 1, I rescale, so I put w of u of v over h of u, and I get a density sitting on this vertical line. Density meaning integral 1. And the idea is that I fix some point where I'm going to try and estimate this second derivative of log. And let's fix that at 0, naturally enough. And then for each other value of the horizontal variable u, I transport the density at 0 to the density at u, this particular density on the vertical line. And I do that with a map t, which depends upon v. That's what's doing the transportation. But, of course, the map also depends on u because it's different for each of the lines. And the infinitesimal formula shows me that the initial density here is the target density at t, where, of course, it's the second variable v that is being transported, times the derivative of t with respect to that transportation variable. And then I have this renormalizing factor h of u, which, of course, is constant, so that doesn't affect the transportation. Right, so all I need from this is that formula. In other words, all I need is that there is a t satisfying this. And what I do with it is take logs, differentiate twice, with respect to u, that is. Then I set u equal to 0. I want the second derivative actually at the point in question. And I use the fact that on this particular line, the transportation is trivial. If I'm transporting from here to itself, nothing happens, of course. It just stays where it is. Okay, so I think I will bring that down now, move a slide, etc. And when you do all those things and rearrange in the right way, guided by, I've said, the desire to extract the Hessian of minus log W, you remember the aim here was to differentiate the proof of Brim-Minkowski, so to use the fact that if W is log concave, then H is also log concave. So the log concavity of W is described by the positivity of the Hessian of minus log W. So we look into the formula, manage to find the Hessian, and then the rest sort of rearranges itself around that. And we get this rather unpleasant-looking expression. Now, it's not so important to look at this. Better to look at the next line, where I've written it slightly differently. So if I take P to be the U derivative of T at zero, then this is just P dashed. This is the Hessian applied both sides to a certain vector. So, of course, that would be positive if the Hessian was positive. And then there's something else subtracted here, and all that matters is that it's the derivative of something divided by W. So this is the right way to read the formula. It's that, plus derivative of something where the P is something or other. It doesn't really matter much what. Okay. And this then gives us the basic formula. I'll explain how. So we take this identity. Remember, what we want to have on the left-hand side is the second derivative of log of h at zero multiplied by h. So we want to remove an h of zero over here. And we also want to get rid of this. So we multiply the whole both sides by w of naught v. And then when we integrate, this derivative will integrate out. So we get rid of that. And here, we're multiplying what is a constant by W naught of V, a constant as far as V is concerned. And so when we integrate it out, all we do is multiply by H of 0. So we get what we wanted. We get the expression, which is H times minus log H double dashed. And it's written in this way, as an integral along with respect to V. And the P function came, of course, from this particular transportation. We can use the transportation formula to obtain a differential equation for P, and this has an analytic solution. There's no difficulty about finding a solution for this in the one-dimensional case. The solution is this, with the appropriate boundary conditions, meaning it decays at infinity. That's what's important. And that means that we have the following basic formula. So this is the basic formula for the value at a point of h minus log h double dashed for the marginal of a two-dimensional density. And I've now turned u in 0 into u. Of course, I did, so I calculated just for 0. Now I write the same thing down. Obviously, 0 is arbitrary, so I get the same thing for u. But now, of course, this p depends also upon u. It's different for each u. So this is the basic formula. You have a two-dimensional density. You take the marginal. I'm ignoring regularity conditions completely. That's obvious. And at a certain stage, they do become important. The regularity here is not entirely trivial, even though this is just a quadratic form. Later on in the applications, there were places where a certain amount of fiddling around was necessary, although nothing too exotic. And the P in question is this. So we sat and stared at this and thought, well, is this any good for anything? And the question we found ourselves asking is, well, since this is a quadratic form in P, is it conceivable that the minimum occurs just at the particular P that we actually want? In other words, the particular P written there that gives this expression. And if it does, then we're happy, because, of course, then it means we can use any old p we like and get an inequality. So rather than use this revolting p, we can put whatever we like in there and get some information out. And so we wrote down the Euler-Lagrange equation for the minimization problem, and sure enough, since the universe is very nice, have I lost a piece of paper, sir? Everything came out right. So sure enough, P does satisfy the Euler-Lagrange equation for the minimization problem, and so modulo calculus of variations, again, known calculus of variations, nothing exotic here. We have a variational inequality for the marginal. If we have a density on the plane, we take the marginal, then we can write this h minus log h double dashed. We can estimate it by this expression for any p that satisfies reasonable regularity conditions, decaying at infinity reasonably nicely, and so on. So we have a way of estimating this quantity that appeared in the new version of the information that I created by putting in that extra term f double dashed. Okay, so how am I doing? Pretty well. So I think maybe I can move that. Now, our aim, of course, was to get the information, which was the integral of this new expression, the h minus log h double dashed. And so if we integrate with respect to u, and I've actually made this into a theorem here. I've put in some conditions so that it's actually a theorem, some regularity conditions. If you start off with a density which is nice, reasonably nice, you take the marginal, then the Fisher information is controlled by this. I now have the u integral as well there, of course, because the information is obtained by integrating the left-hand side here with respect to u. And the conditions on P are just precisely the conditions you would expect. When you expand this quantity, the Hessian applied to these vectors, you get various cross terms, and as long as the cross terms are integrable, then the formula makes sense. So the conditions here are exactly what you would expect. Well, plus, of course, P ought to be differentiable if we're going to differentiate it, but other than that, there's nothing unexpected. Right. Now, at this point, I should mention that although I've done everything for just two random variables, real random variables, and only two of them, or rather a density on R2, I haven't even talked about random variables yet, I've only talked about marginals in general. One can do this in higher dimensions. Naturally, the formulae become a bit more complicated. There's a partial differential equation, and solving it is slightly more complicated. But the only important point is that this term here, the derivative part of the variational functional, is replaced by this expression, the trace of the derivative of P squared. So the derivative of P is a matrix. You take its square in the matrix sense. This is not the square of the trace. This is the trace of the square. Maybe I'll kind of make that clearer. And this, at first sight, looks a bit strange, right? Normally, when you have a matrix and you want to talk about traces and you multiply two matrices together, the two you're going to pick will be the matrix and its adjoint. You want to get something positive. But here, we have the trace of the square, and for a general matrix, of course, that isn't necessarily positive. There's no reason why trace of the square of a matrix should be positive. In one dimension, it is. I mean, it's a square of a real number, but in higher dimensions, it needn't be. Now, what this, the reason, if you like, that this appears, or the context in which it is easiest to understand why this appears, is in the context of the standard transportation proofs of Brun-Minkowski. So there are several different transportation proofs of Brun-Minkowski using different transportation maps. The earliest one was by Knoerter, who used a map which was upper triangular. And if you have an upper triangular map and you square it, then its trace will be positive. Then the trace of the square will be positive. There's no problem about that. The new proof uses the Prunier map, which is what's going to be talked about a great deal this week. And the Prunier map is a gradient. The P, as it were, would be the gradient. So its derivative would give you a Hessian. So it's symmetric. and then you square it, you are indeed taking a positive definite operator. You're taking the trace of a semi-definite operator, and so the trace is positive. So either of the two classical proofs give, the classical proof and the modern proof give you something which is positive. And there you can understand how you're going to get Brum-Minkowski out. Strictly speaking, of course, I shouldn't have said this at the time when I've moved to the information. It's the second derivative of log h which matters. But the point is that if you start off with a density which is log concave, this will be positive. You apply it to this p, and then here you have something which will be positive, provided you cook up the p properly. And this is the reason, as it were, or the context in which to understand why we don't get something which at first sight might seem more natural, namely the derivative times its adjoint. Now, it turns out, this is hardly surprising, that once you've written the theorem down, you don't have to prove it by transportation. It's much, much easier to prove, especially if you write it in a slightly different form, as I have there. It turns out that the formula we've got involving the derivative term and the Hessian term can be combined into a single formula, which for some purposes, as you'll see, is slightly nicer. And the upper bound for the information is this expression, the square of a derivative divided by w. So it looks rather like the information, except, divergence. It is a derivative, but it's the divergence. So it looks like the information, except we've replaced just a certain one-dimensional derivative of w by the divergence of this quantity, pw, where p is any vector field satisfying this linear relation, which tells you that in the direction you're calculating the information, the derivative only picks up the derivative of w. There's no derivative of p. Okay, so this is how the thing fits together. And in this form, you can prove the inequality much more simply, and this will be done in Shiri's talk. In both of the applications, in both of the talks that will be given tomorrow, the way to use the formula will be, in principle, the same. Instead of choosing the optimal function, which you can write down, or you can at least solve for the optimal function, the trouble is that when you do it, all you recover is the original formula for the information. So, of course, it tells you nothing, and you get exactly the right number. What you need to do is choose a function which definitely isn't optimal, but which is cooked up in such a way that you can exploit the characteristics of the situation. So in the case of independent random variables, what you have is that the density on the plane or on Rn will factor. You want to cook up a function which will exploit the fact that the density factors in order to enable you to make some calculations. So the whole point is that you definitely don't want to choose an optimal p. You want to choose one which fits the situation you're trying to understand. In the case of the entropy growth, you are going to choose your p, again, deliberately non-optimal, but in such a way that it relates the density you get for summing a certain number to the random variables to the density you get for summing the next higher number or whatever it may be. So this, in both cases, will be the point of the formula to choose a non-optimal p, which you can actually do something with. Okay, I'm going to stop there. As I say, my collaborators will continue with the applications. Any questions? Yes. We haven't got the application. So we would need more to get the application. And indeed, I don't believe that this method will solve the problem, so I don't really mention it anymore now. I'll explain later. It's a little more complicated, but I'll explain later if you like. I don't think this is actually going to solve the problem we originally wanted to solve, but that's life, right?
And it is the same problem.
What?
And it is the same problem which you wanted to solve.
When you say the same problem, what do you mean?
Okay.
Are they less cryptic?
Well, the question wasn't so cryptic, but the answer was cryptic, yeah.
Well, let's thank the speaker once more.